Well, as Priscilla said, my name is Jennifer Webster, and we are new to Texas. We live in College Station, and our family worships with the BCS Church of Christ, and I'm really excited to be here with you today. I've been assigned the topic of valor in evangelism. You know, I read a survey recently that said that about 95% of people that claim to be Christians have never taught another person the gospel. Do you believe that? Do you think it could be that high? I'm not sure about that. Do you think that if we surveyed the church, true Christians, that that percentage would be just as high for us? 95% of people who claim to be Christians have not taught someone else the gospel. I really don't know about that. I know that I personally have not done enough studies, so I'm not sure how high it would be. But I also know this. I've never had someone who's a member of the Church of Christ knock on my door. And I've never had someone who's a member of the Church of Christ that didn't know that I was already a Christian try to convert me. I've never had that happen. This even happened. When I was in high school, I thought that I was the only one who was a member of the church. Imagine my surprise one day when I was sitting in Bible class and this boy from our high school came in and sat down and we looked at each other and we both said, "I didn't know you were a Christian." We were just shocked to even discover that the other person was a Christian. Now, why is this the case? Why did I not know that he was a Christian? Why didn't he know that I was a Christian? Why has no one ever knocked on my door? Well, I don't know why we're not more vocal about the gospel. Are we ashamed of the gospel? Are we afraid to teach other people? Do we not care about other people? I don't think that's it. But I do know this, that one major reason that the church is not growing like it needs to is because we are not teaching the lost. We are not doing it. You know, the growth in our congregations, it often depends on people moving in from other areas or maybe someone getting angry and moving in from another congregation to ours. A lot of times that's the growth that we're experiencing. It seems like a lot of the time we've just delegated our duties to evangelize to this man that we refer to as our evangelist. Now, my husband's an evangelist. We need evangelists. But Acts 8 and verse 3 tells us that it's not just the responsibility of the evangelist in our congregation, but it's the responsibility of every Christian to be teaching other people. You know, we support radio programs. We support television programs. We give money to missionaries. And these are excellent methods of evangelism. But we often neglect to just try to save our lost friends, our lost neighbors, our lost family members. You know, if each one of us in here won one, our buildings would have to, they would just be bursting at the seams. We'd all have to add on if just each one won one and we kept up that cycle. We've just generally lost the evangelistic zeal and fervor that the church was once known for. I know you probably don't watch Saturday Night Live. It's not a good show, but they had this skit on there when they had the Olympics in Utah and when they were slaloming, is that a word? They were doing the slalom down the side of the mountain. And in this skit, two people ski up beside the guys that are in the slalom, if that's what you call it, the little, and they were Mormons and they were trying to convert the people as they're in the Olympics. Now, that's really funny. You know, they're in Utah. I get why they did that. But why didn't they have two members of the church beside them skiing, trying to convert them? Because we're not known for that like the Mormons are. And we need to do something about that. I found this survey about evangelism, and I think it's really helpful to give us some insights as to why sometimes we're not as zealous as we need to be about evangelism. 9% of the people surveyed said they were just too busy. They were too busy to try to teach somebody else the gospel. 28% felt that they themselves did not have enough knowledge to try to teach someone else. 12% said that their own lives did not befit the gospel. They were not living like they needed to in order to teach someone else. 0% said that they didn't care. What do you think the other 51% said? Why do you think the reason was that they did not try to teach someone the gospel? It's because they're afraid. Now, like I said, I've been assigned the topic of valor in evangelism, courage in evangelism, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. We don't want to be in that 51% that's afraid to teach someone the gospel. We know that Matthew 28, verse 19 tells us that it's a command that we're to go and make disciples of all nations. And we also know, we have the common sense to know that the most effective form of evangelism is often friendship evangelism. Now, 0% in our survey said that they didn't care, and 51% said that they were afraid. why? Why don't we have more valor when it comes to evangelism? 2 Timothy 1:7 says that God does not give us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. So what are we afraid of? What are you afraid of in your everyday life? Are you afraid of the dark? Are you afraid of the water? Can you swim? What if you were going by a lake and you saw someone drowning and you can't swim? What would you do? Well, a lot of us, regardless of whether we could swim, we would go in after them, wouldn't we? We would for sure throw out a lifeline or reach out our hand to try and help that person make it to safety. Are you afraid of fire? I don't want to get burned. I'm afraid of fire. But if you were driving by a burning building and you saw that there was time for you to get in there and help someone get out of that burning building, would you just drive by? Well, of course you wouldn't. You would stop and you'd help that person out of the building. You'd help the person out of the water if they were drowning, and you'd help the person, if you could, get out of the burning building. So why is it that we can so easily overcome those physical fears that we might have of the water and of fire and help someone physically, but when it comes to spiritual matters, we kind of look the other way when it's our lost coworker that we're considering? We're really nice to the cashier and we're a good example, but we never invite her to worship, and we hope and we pray for salvation for our friends and our families, but we don't invite them to have a Bible study with us. Matthew 10:28 says this, "And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." What are we afraid of? What are the things that we're afraid of when it comes to evangelism? Listen, hell is hot. Eternity is long. Life is unsure. Death is certain. And outside of Jesus Christ, there's no salvation. Acts 4:32 says, "Neither is there salvation in any other." These truths ought to be the passion of our lives. Everybody that we meet ought to know that we're members of the Church of Christ, that we're Christians, and that we want them to be too. And why? Everybody ought to know that. You know, I used to be afraid of spiders. How many of you are afraid of spiders? That's a pretty common fear. Well, I used to be so afraid of spiders until I lived in a house that was absolutely infested with brown recluse spiders. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. They were everywhere. They were in our boxes. They were in stacks of papers. They liked clothes that my kids threw on the ground. One day I bent over and picked up my child's pajama pants, and I held them like this, and I saw this brown leg just come over the edge. And I looked, and it was a brown recluse about that big right beside my pinky. Once I even pulled back the covers to the bed, and there was one crawling right where I wanted to lay. It was very bad. They were everywhere. So what did we do about that? Did we ignore them? No, we didn't ignore them. We faced that fear. We set out sticky traps. We sprayed poison. We were very careful. We cleared up the clutter. We did everything that we knew how to do to get rid of those brown recluse spiders, or at least control them. And one day, we drove away from that house. We moved out of that house. And I left not only that house, but I left that fear of spiders behind too, because I had more knowledge about it. I had faced it. We'd overcome it. You know, brown recluse spiders, they don't want to bite you. They're not very aggressive. They only do it if they have to, or they feel like they have to. Have you heard the old quote, "There's nothing to fear except fear itself"? You know, the worst that I thought could happen was I would be bitten by those spiders, and it never happened. Not one member of our family got bitten, and we didn't bring any of them to Texas with us. We were very careful. For a long time, I wouldn't let my children kill spiders in our house until I had looked at it to make sure that it wasn't a brown recluse. So we're going to do what I did with those spiders. We're going to do that with spiritual matters today. We're going to face those fears. We're going to talk about what we're afraid of and figure out why we're afraid and what we can do about that so we can have more valor in our personal evangelism. The first thing that I think we're afraid of when it comes to personal evangelism is this: loss. We're afraid of losing something. And in particular, we're afraid of losing that close relationship that we have with our friends and family. Now, we don't enjoy conflict, and we ought not to enjoy conflict. The easiest way to do that is when you're talking to someone to just make sure you agree on everything that you talk about. 1 Timothy 2:24-26 starts out like this: "The servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men. We must not strive. We want to do the right thing, don't we? We want to get along with people. We want to do like Romans 12 and verse 18 says, where it says to, if it's possible, live peacefully with all men. That's what we want to do, and that's what we ought to do. It says, though, that we must not strive. We must be gentle unto all men. But it also says that we're apt to teach, patient, in meekness, instructing those who oppose themselves. And if you go on down, it says that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil. So you see, our main purpose in being friends with someone is not to talk about the weather or get a recommendation for your favorite nail place or whatever the things that we talk about. There's nothing wrong with those things, and it is part of friendship. But our main thing is we're supposed to be instructing them that they will, because they oppose themselves, and so that they can recover themselves out of the snare of the devil. It's funny how sometimes with the people that we love the most, we're afraid to bring up the subject of the church, the subject of the gospel. Because, you know, that is really a perfect example of love. I mean, what could be more loving to tell someone what they really need to hear? I heard someone say once, how much do you have to dislike or hate someone to know the way of eternal life and not share that with that person? How much do you have to dislike someone to keep that to yourself? The true test of a friendship or a relationship is this, whether you're more concerned with having a friend or being a friend. Those are two different things. How can we overcome the fear that we often have of losing that relationship? Well, first, you've got to love your friends and your family just like you love yourself. Matthew 22:39 says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Would you want them to teach you? Well, of course you would. Do unto others, Matthew 7:12. So we need to teach them like we would want them to teach us. When you're afraid of losing your friends, you need to remember that the friend that counts the most is Jesus. John 15:13 says, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And so Jesus is our friend. We need to realize that it doesn't matter if someone doesn't like us. It matters whether we are pleasing to God. John 12:43, for they love the praise of men rather than the praise of God. Do you want to be popular with men, or do you want the praise of God? You have to decide that when you're trying to approach someone with the gospel. Try to picture your friend on the judgment day. What's worse? I think it's worse to face your friend on the judgment day having never told her about the gospel. 5 years. That's how long it took me to convert my friend Lisa. 5 long years. I had begun to doubt that it would ever come to pass. But then one day, she was baptized into Christ for the remission of her sins. 5 years later. It was a great day. I moved away. We still kept in touch. I moved back. When I moved back, I called her so we could set up a time to have dinner or something. And she told me, I never want to see you again. As a matter of fact, don't call me again. See, I've made some decisions in my life that they're not right. They're not right. But I'm very happy with those decisions. And I know that you will encourage me to do the right thing, and I don't want to. Don't call me again. Well, I did call her again, but I didn't get a good response, and we're not friends. I kind of think I am her friend, though. I'm one of the best friends that she's ever had because I told her what she needed to hear. And as much as it hurt to lose that friendship and to be talked to the way that she talked to me and to see her walk away from the truth, at least I know on the day of judgment that I gave her the opportunity that she does know the truth and she does have something to come back to if she chooses. Okay, another thing that we fear losing is this, a job or a promotion. You know, you try to spread the gospel at work, someone may report you for harassment if they don't like it. And you're really not supposed to be doing that. That could happen. How many of your husbands have ever been fired for preaching the truth? We've had it happen. It happens to the best of us. Well, this is what I have to say to that. Two things. God will take care of you. Psalm 37:25 says, I have been young, and now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging for bread. God will take care of you. And the next thing I have to say about losing a job, if you lose it because you're spreading the gospel or preaching the truth, is this, so be it. It's the way it is. Philippians 3:8, yet indeed I also count all things lost for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish, as nothing, that I may gain Christ. We need to keep our eyes on our priority. Okay, the last thing I want to talk to you about as far as the fear of losing things. We fear losing our free time, and we don't want to admit it. It takes time to teach someone the gospel. You have to reach out. You have to set up appointments. It takes time. But you will not reach the day of judgment and wish that you had watched more television, that you had quilted more or knitted more or read more. You will not. And if your hobbies are taking up an inordinate amount of your time, then you are wasting the time that God has given you and will answer for that. Ephesians 5:16 says, redeem the time, buy back the time. It wasn't that long ago that we were sitting in services and we were singing, I want to be a worker for the Lord. And my daughter Sophie was sitting beside me and she slammed her book shut and stuck it in the back of the pew. And I asked her, what's wrong? And she said, I can't sing that song today. I'm just too tired. I don't want to be a worker. But at least she was trying to worship in spirit and truth, right? It was funny. You know, she's very young. But do we say that? Maybe not out loud. I'm tired. I can't sing that song. I don't want to be a worker for the Lord. Sometimes we do. And we need the honesty of children sometimes to admit it so that we can face that fear. You know, the early Christians knew about real loss. We worry about losing a friend here or there. We worry about losing a promotion for more money or a job. But they knew about real loss. Hebrews 10, 32 through 34 says, but recall, remember the former days in which, after you were illuminated, or after you had received the light, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle, both by reproaches and tribulations, or you were publicly insulted, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me and my chains, and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. And that's what we need to remember, that we have an enduring possession in heaven. Okay, the second thing, the second fear that I think we have when it comes to evangelism is this. The unknown. How many of you are afraid of the unknown? I know I am. I will not do a question and answer if you do not give me the questions beforehand. I just won't do it. I have to do a live podcast this next week, live. I've already told them to send me the talking points so that I can study up and have some good things to say. I won't swim in the creek at camp because I can't see the bottom, and I'm not going to do it. What if there's a snake in the creek? What if there's a branch that makes me think there's a snake in the creek? You know, I've seen that episode of Little House on the Prairie. I'm not doing it. I'm not getting in that creek. But spiritually speaking, the what ifs are a whole lot more serious. What if she's been divorced and remarried unscripturally? What if you encounter that? What if she's part of a religion that I don't know anything about? What if she asks me a question that I don't know? What if I fail? What if she gets angry at me? What if he doesn't care? What if she points out an inconsistency in my life when I start trying to teach her? We've got to let go of the idea that you can't teach another person unless you are sure of the outcome. Was Abraham sure of the outcome? He was not. In Hebrews 11, verse 8, it says that he obeyed and went out not knowing where he was going. He didn't know where he was going. And sometimes when we start a study with someone, we don't know where that study is going. We have no idea where it will end up, what twists and turns it will take. When Christopher Columbus set out to discover new worlds, people were afraid of the unknown. They were afraid that he was just going to sail right off the edge of the earth. Now, we laugh about that today because we know that that fear is very unfounded. And they would have known that, too, if they just read Isaiah 40, verse 22. Many of our fears never come true, but some of them are not unfounded. Some of them are very real. The unknown is very real. James 4, verse 14 talks about how we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And Proverbs 27, 1 says, we don't know what a day will bring. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. We don't know even what the rest of this day is going to bring. But we keep on living, don't we? We keep on living. We keep on working. And we need to keep on teaching other people. This is how you can overcome the fear of the unknown. First of all, you pray for wisdom and learning how to deal with whatever comes your way. James 1:5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given unto him. If you lack, you ask, and it will be given. I used to teach kindergarten in this rural school in Alabama, and I had this student who at the end of kindergarten, he didn't know his colors. He couldn't write his name. He needed to repeat kindergarten. So I had to call a parent-teacher conference. And I was scared. I was really young. I was just in my early 20s, and I had no idea what I was doing. Well, let me back up for a minute. I used to work at the bank. When I was in college, I paid my tuition by working at the bank in town. And there was this woman that came through, and if I messed up on anything, her deposit slip, her check, it didn't matter. She got out of that car, and she cursed me, and she'd go in the bank and complain and just pitch a fit. Well, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? When I opened the door for this child's mother, it was that woman. And I started to pray. I really did fear slightly for my physical safety, but also I feared for this child. He didn't need to be taken out of the school. And I feared for my job, because remember I said it was a small rural school, and we had 28 students in kindergarten, and that's the exact number that we had to split the class so that I could have a class and the other lady could have a class. And if he left, we had 27 and I didn't have a job. So I started to pray for wisdom, pray for safety. And this verse came to mind. A soft answer turns away wrath. I just kept saying that to myself. A soft answer turns away wrath. The lady came in. She was cursing as usual. She was angry. And she would say, I'm going to take Jonathan and put him over at Piedmont. Maybe he'll be in a good school then. And I would say, well, you know, we have a lot to offer you here at Spring Garden. And then she would say, I'm going to put him in the other class. Maybe he'll get a good teacher there. And I would say, yes, she is an excellent teacher. He will have a good teacher over there. We went back and forth, and she began to soften. And at the end of the meeting, she turned to her son and she said, Jonathan, you didn't tell me you had such a sweet and pretty teacher. And I like that a whole lot better than the cursing that we started with. So you see, you pray for wisdom and God gives it to you. You can use Bible verses. You can repeat them. You will know how to handle some things. You need to equip yourself with a good basic knowledge of the fundamentals. You do not have to cover premillennialism in your first study with someone. Just a good basic knowledge will take you a long way. 1 Peter 3:15 says, be ready to give a defense. Be ready to give an answer. So we need to do that. You can take a Fishers of Men course. There are other Bible study courses that you can take to prepare yourself to do this. You need to be willing to say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. You know, our pride can get in the way of us having a study if we're afraid to not know. Proverbs 11:2 says, when pride comes, then comes shame. But with the humble is wisdom. If you can have humility in a study, when you're faced with something that you don't know, that's okay. You'll just go find out. Don't make not knowing a bigger deal than it is, like I did one time. I used to go to the graduate classes at the Memphis School of Preaching with my husband. I was only 18. I didn't know a lot, but I didn't know that it was odd that I was going to these graduate classes with all these preachers and then me right there in the middle of all of them. Well, I wasn't listening very well one day, and Brother Keith Mosier was talking about Romans, the book of Romans, and he asked a question to me, but I didn't know the question, so I couldn't give him the answer, and I just froze and looked at him, and then somebody down the table saved me with the answer, and it was very complicated. The answer was Abraham. It was so embarrassing. I still remember where I was sitting, what I was wearing, who, all this. Do you think anybody else lost sleep over that? They didn't remember after dinner. It was done. They didn't remember. So don't make not knowing a bigger deal than it is because of your pride. And you need to be afraid and just do it anyway. You need to be afraid of being afraid. Be afraid not to. What does Revelation 21 and verse 8 say in the very beginning, the very first category of people that cannot go to heaven? The fearful. So we need to be afraid to be afraid. And you need to be okay with not knowing for sure what the outcome is going to be. You don't have to be afraid of the unknown, because it's only unknown to you. One of my favorite verses is this, Psalm 46 and verse 2. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in time of trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives away, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea. He is a very present help in time of trouble. One time, Wade had a gospel meeting in East Tennessee, and we all went with him, and I thought it was going to be a great idea to take three of my younger children on a hike by myself. We left Sophie napping and him studying in the hotel room. We went to the visitor center, and we asked for a recommendation of an easy hike. And I guess by easy, he thought I meant strenuous and very dangerous, because he sent me on one that was not easy. And I had these three children with me, and we got going on this hike, and I realized this is not easy. So what do you think I did? Well, I just let them stumble over the rocks and fall in the water and fall off the cliff, right? Of course I didn't do that. I walked ahead of them. I held their hands over the creeks. I helped pull them up on the sides of the hills. That I made them stay away from the edge. I took care of them. And see, no matter what path we walk down, that's how God is. He goes before us. He's one step ahead. He opens the doors for us. He gives us opportunities. And 1 Corinthians 3:6 says that He gives the increase. It's not all dependent upon us. I found this phrase in the Bible. I love it. I love this phrase. And I'm going to give you two places that I know that it's in the Bible. And the first one is in Deuteronomy 31 and verse 8. And it's where Moses is assuring Israel of the constant presence of God with them. And it just says this: the Lord went before them. And you can find it in Exodus 13 and verse 21. And it says, the Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud to lead them on the way. I don't think it's an accident that we don't always know what's going to happen. Because, you know, if I know, then I feel like I can control the situation. And if I don't know, then somebody else is in control, right? I may not like that feeling, but somebody else is in control. Jeremiah 10:23 says this: O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. See, we can only prepare ourselves like we talked about. We cannot let the fear of the unknown stop us. We've just got to let God take care of the rest. We do the right thing and God will be before us. Okay, the third thing that we're afraid of when it comes to personal evangelism is this: being judged. Now, we hear that often, don't we? Don't judge me. We hear that phrase a lot. And this just means, let me do what I want and don't tell me what to do. Don't correct me. Or you might hear, you're not my judge. God is my judge. Now, I don't get that one, because that is often made by people who are living in blatant sin. You are not my judge. God is my judge. Now, I know that Psalm 89:14 says, righteousness and justice are the foundation of thy throne. And I know that Genesis 18:25 says that the judge of all the earth is going to do right. But Hebrews 10:31 says that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. So if I was not living right, for me to brag and say, God is my judge, I don't know that that would be very comforting. But that's not the kind of judging that I'm talking about. When I say that we're afraid of being judged, I'm just talking about the fear of standing before a group or maybe just an individual and having our teaching ability put at the mercy of the opinion of other people. Did you know that the average person ranks public speaking above, the fear of public speaking above the fear of death? They would rather die than do some public speaking. And I understand that. But why do we fear public speaking? Do we think that we're going to forget what we were going to say? We don't want to make a mistake. Maybe that's it. We think we're unqualified and somebody out there knows a lot more than I do about this. We fear that our life's inconsistencies may be pointed out. We fear that people will think, oh, she's a hypocrite. Well, this is how we overcome that fear of being judged. First of all, you've got to prepare yourself. 2 Timothy 2:15 says, study to show yourself approved. You've got to study so that you're prepared. And don't act like you're never going to make a mistake. You study hard and then you be humble if someone points something out. You know, you're going to tell a joke and no one's going to laugh. You're going to tell an illustration and people are going to look at you like, what has that got to do with the lesson? You're going to skip a verse. You're going to stumble. If you wait until you're perfect at cooking, your family is going to starve. And if you wait until you're a perfect presenter, then the gospel is going to go largely untaught and people will starve spiritually. Now, this is not a talent show. We're not on display for our abilities. Now, we do want to be effective speakers, and it's good to want to be eloquent and to work towards being better at that. We ought to do the best that we can for God, but you're never going to get better at it if you don't just do it. You've got to just do it if someone asks you to do it. We don't want to be like Moses in Exodus 4. When the Lord told Moses to go to Pharaoh and the Israelites, and what did Moses say? Oh, I can't do that. I'm not eloquent. I can't do that. And the Lord said, who made your mouth? Who made you? And Moses begged him to send someone else. We don't want to be like Moses in that instance. You need to remember that the group, the people, asked you and not someone else. Now, someone else may know more overall, but you prepared for that lesson and you're an expert at what you have there in your notes. You know, I had been listening to some weak and wishy-washy women's lessons on the role of women. And I came home and I was just fed up. I was fed up with what I was hearing and not hearing, things that needed to be said. So I said to my family, you know, rather than just being a complainer about this, maybe I'll be part of the solution. Maybe if someone were to ever ask me, maybe sometime in the future to speak, I will say yes. This was maybe 3 years ago. I'm not really sure, but it's been not too long, but some years ago. The next day, I got a phone call from this lady, and she said, you've got to help us. Our speaker has canceled, and we need a fill-in. And I said, well, when is this? 3 weeks. I had 3 weeks to prepare two lessons, and I had never prepared one. And I said, well, who am I filling in for? Just curious. Sheila Butt. And I thought, I'm not doing this. I am not going to replace Sheila Butt. And my girls heard me say that. And they said, but Mom, you said. So 3 weeks later, I found myself with my knees knocking together, scared to death in front of a group of women trying to make it through. But before I did that, guess who I talked to? I talked to Sheila. And she gave me some really good advice. And I want to just share with you what she said to me. She said, okay, listen, you don't have to know everything, but don't fill your lesson with fluff. Make sure that you can say, if you have the opportunity, listen, you need to hear what I've got to say. I've done some study on this, and I've got something that's going to help you, and it's so important that you listen up so that you can learn something. You've got to feel very passionate about what you're talking about. She also said to just be yourself. Don't dress differently than you normally do. Don't get a new haircut and, you know, just try to keep the focus off of yourself and put it on the Word, because that's where our confidence should be anyway. You know, it's not about you, it's about Him. And if you think about the Apostle Paul after his conversion and he had begun to preach and teach instead of kill Christians, in Galatians 1:24 it says, and they glorified God in me. They glorified God. And when we are speaking, people ought to be able to glorify God. It's not about us. It's not about our ability or our inability. It's about the Word. Remember who you're trying to please anyway. God always judges fairly. Remember, we talked about that at the beginning of this point. In Galatians 1:10 says, for do I now seek to persuade men or God, or do I seek to please men? For if I still please men, I would not be a servant of Christ. We want to serve Christ and we want to please Him before we please men. Okay, the fourth thing, I think this is a big one, especially with young people, but all of us, if we're admitting it, this is a big one. The fourth thing that I think gets in the way of us having more valor in evangelism is this. We're afraid of being ridiculed or mocked. We're afraid of being made fun of. When I was about 16, I took it upon myself to become more serious about being a Christian. And there were some things that I had to quit doing, and there were some things that I had to start doing. Do you think that I was ridiculed just a little bit in high school after that? I mean, listen, I was cool. I was. My girls don't believe it, but I was. And then almost overnight, I became uncool very quickly. It was so hard to make decisions as a teenager pretty much on my own in the face of that ridicule, but it was a good thing. You know how Romans 8:28 says that? All things work together for good. It was not a good thing that I was mocked, but it toughened me up because then I found myself in a college classroom a few years later. And the psychology professor, in the middle of her lecture that had nothing to do with religion, said this, "Hey, is there anybody out here that's a member of the Church of Christ?" So I raised my hand and she said, "Oh, good, you. Well, can you tell me, is it true that you think you're the only ones going to heaven?" The class just laughed and had someone argue. It was terrible. But that was a good thing, too, because then I went to graduate school and it was worse. And in graduate school, I took this philosophy class and the professor said, "In order to make an A in this class, your presentation has to be very controversial." So I sat through those presentations on abortion, euthanasia, safe sex, and when I argued with them about alcohol, the class laughed so hard, even the professor threw back his head and laughed out loud at the things that I had to say. So I decided that I'm doing my presentation on absolute truth. And then I found out that my professor, Dr. Harry Rose, had once been a faithful member of the church. But it was too late. I couldn't back out. I don't think I would have anyway, but it was going on. I was doing absolute truth. So you ever heard the phrase, "Speak the truth even if your voice shakes"? Well, my voice shook. I was scared to death. I needed an A in that class. I was about to graduate with my degree. He sat at the back of the classroom and looked out the back window the entire time, never looking at me. I talked for 30 minutes, and I just can't tell you how frightening it was. I had no idea what was going through his mind, and I was at his mercy for my grade. You know those high school peers that laughed at me? 7 of them became Christians, and 1 set of parents of one of those children became Christians too. And I don't know what happened to Dr. Harry Rose, but after the 30-minute talk that I gave, there was 30 minutes of questions from the students, and these were adults. This was graduate school, not undergraduate. And then afterwards, I had 2 chase me down the hall to ask me questions about the division of the old and the new laws. So I'm telling you that. Oh, and by the way, I made an A. I made an A in that class. Apparently it was controversial enough, and he was serious when he said that's what he wanted. The reason I tell you this is so that you can see that sometimes our biggest fears, the things that intimidate us the most, they're unfounded. And sometimes we endure mocking, and good comes from it. Well, always good comes from everything. But you know what I mean. You can see the immediate results of how you endured that mocking. And even if good does not come from that ridicule, you endure. 1 Corinthians 4:12 tells us that when we're persecuted, we endure. We put up with it. We stick with it. You know, we can expect mocking and ridicule from the world. The Bible tells us it's going to happen, but sometimes it comes in the form of another Christian mocking you. Now, how easy is that to put up with? How easy is that to endure? Not very. Have you ever told a group of parents that your child would not be going to the movie with the rest of the youth group because it was inappropriate, and have them roll their eyes at you and talk about you when you're not around? Of course you have, if that's happened. Have you ever been called a Pharisee? What about a legalist? Anyone ever use those terms with you? I see you nodding your heads. How many of you have ever been made fun of for being very diligent about what you do and what you allow your children to do, like Proverbs 4:23 tells us to do, and then been made fun of by another Christian? I've had elders' wives make fun of me for my decision to stay home and raise my children. Elders' wives, to my face, more than once. One time, okay, this retreat. This is the first retreat that I've been on since the first, and I can't really say I'm on it since I didn't spend the night, but I'm here. When Priscilla said the word retreat, I just had flashbacks of the first retreat that I ever did in Georgia. And that was a retreat where I drove 9 hours in the dark. It snowed. I got lost. My maps weren't working. I finally made it down into the camp. I was put in this cabin with my girls. The power went out. It was 27 degrees. I didn't sleep 1 minute. And I said I would never do another retreat again. But here I am, and I'm glad that I was able to face that fear. But what happened at that retreat, the cold, the getting lost, the dark, that's not what really made me not want to do it. That did contribute. But what happened was, right over here, there were these women sitting, and I was speaking on modesty because they told me to. And I just don't think that word means what they thought it meant. Because I started speaking on modesty, and they started getting on their phones and talking and laughing. So I would walk over that way and try to get their attention back. And they would listen when I went over there. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I walked away, they started again. And I thought, what in the world? So when we were leaving to go home, I complained to my girls about it because they'd been sitting over there with them and knew about it. And Claire said, you know what they were doing, Mom? When you would talk about modesty, they were pulling up pictures of themselves dressed the way you were describing they ought not to be dressed and showing their bikini pictures and their little short shorts to each other and laughing at you. These were Christian women that knew better. I'm not talking about these are Christian women. They certainly should have known better. So I said, no more retreats for me. That will be the last. You know, I can't promise you that if you're bringing the gospel to someone that they will not laugh at you. As a matter of fact, probably it's going to happen. Doesn't the Bible teach that? The Bible teaches in 2 Timothy 3:12 that all who will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. And sometimes that persecution comes in the form of ridicule or mocking. Here's a couple of verses that might make you feel better about the mocking and ridicule. Luke 6 and verse 22 says, blessed are you when people hate you and they exclude you and they revile you. Matthew 5:11 says, blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you. John 15:18-21 tells us why people do this. Why do they do this to us? It says this in the last part, but all these things they do unto you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. They do not know Jesus. They do not know the truth. And that's why they, in ignorance, will ridicule and mock you. And you just keep bringing them the truth because they'll be sorry if they will ever accept it. They'll be sorry about that. You know, other people in the Bible were mocked and ridiculed. Remember Nehemiah when he was building the wall? Sanballat and others mocked him, and Jesus was mocked. I mean, you are in good company when you're mocked and ridiculed. Luke 23, verse 11 says that then Herod and his soldiers mocked him. He was mocked, and he was ridiculed. Ridiculing, mocking, making fun of people, that is a tool of the devil that has been around for a very, very long time. It's a powerful tool, especially with kids. It's a powerful tool that people use to bully each other, to make their own faults less obvious, to coerce somebody into doing the wrong thing, or just to be mean. People use it. But it's something we have to teach our children early on. You don't make fun of people, but you also have to teach them to be tough when, not if, when they are made fun of. It is not fun to be made fun of. I'll tell you that. I was in this homeschool co-op, and they were going to study the history of the church. It was a history co-op. And I began to realize, okay, these women think that the Catholic Church was the beginning of the church. So I began to talk to them about the book of Acts. And it was just a small group of us, maybe 7 or 8. And I couldn't get it through to them. I just kept talking about the church, the New Testament church, the book of Acts, the beginning of the church. And finally, I saw the light bulb go on in some of their faces. And one of them said, whoa, wait a minute. Are you telling us that you are a member of the church that we read about in the book of Acts? And I was so excited. I said, yes, that is exactly what I am telling you. And we're not in that co-op anymore. That was the last day. So you will be mocked. You will be ridiculed. But this is how we handle that. We realize that we are not alone. And this is one of my favorite verses for that. Isaiah 41 and verse 10. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous hand. You know, I look around in this room and I think, not only is God with me, but I think many, if not all of you, are with me too. Now, you may not be physically with me when I'm teaching a Bible study with my neighbor, but I bet I could call you and I could talk to you about that study and you'd have encouragement and advice for me and you would be with me. Another way that we handle the ridicule and mocking that will come our way is this. We don't ridicule and mock our perpetrators. I cannot stand when a preacher gets up in the pulpit and mocks and ridicules anyone. I don't care how wrong they are. I don't care how silly their false doctrine is. I do not like it when we mock and ridicule other people. It is mean and it is ineffective. 1 Peter 2:23 says this, when Jesus was reviled, he reviled not again. Luke 6:28 says, what are we to do to people who mock and ridicule us? People who don't treat us right. We're to bless them. We bless those who curse us and we pray for those who abuse us. And we keep teaching, we keep trying, regardless of the mocking. In the book of Acts, Acts chapter 5 and verse 28, it says this, did not we strictly command you that you should not teach in this name? And behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching and are determined to make us guilty of the man's blood. The apostles were told, you better stop doing this. You've got to choose which voices you're going to listen to and which voices you're going to ignore. Are you going to listen to the mockers? Are you going to listen to the scorners? In the next verse, verse 29, it says this, then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than man. The next thing you need to do in order to overcome the fear of being ridiculed or mocked is this. Examine your life and make sure that the ridicule has no merit. A lot of the time when you try to teach someone else, they'll say, oh, you, and they'll fill in the blank, or you're just a hypocrite. There's hypocrite. Are you a hypocrite? Romans 2:21 says, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, dishonor God by breaking the law. For as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because you are not living right. High school was the hardest for me. It was my senior year, and I was a cheerleader, and I knew this is not right. I need to quit. As I was walking out the door to go talk to my coach, my mother was leaning out the window saying, you are going to regret this. Don't do it. Why are you doing this? And I kept going, and I did it. See, she didn't believe me. I mean, I've done it all these years. Why now, all of a sudden? See, my life was not measuring up. Later, a boy at school asked me, why did you do something so drastic? And I said, well, the skirts are too short and the dances are provocative. That's why I quit. And he looked at me for a second and he said, really, why? I mean, he didn't believe me. See, my life had not matched the gospel. And I had not been able to teach anyone before then because I was not living in a way that reflected the gospel. So be sure that your life reflects the gospel. You know, Christ, he wants us to be bold. He wants us to have valor in evangelism. He wants to overcome our need for human approval. And many times we catch ourselves being way too influenced by what other people think and what they say. And I want you to think about Bartimaeus, if you ever find that happening to you. Remember blind Bartimaeus? In Mark 10, verses 46 through 52, it says that blind Bartimaeus was sitting by the side of the road, and when he heard that Jesus was coming, he began to shout and ask Jesus to have mercy on him. And the people around him said, be quiet. They tried to silence him. They told him to just be quiet. So what was his response? He cried even louder. Are you going to let the opinions of other people silence you? Or are you just going to proclaim the gospel even louder? That's what we need to do, because remember, Romans 8:31 says, if God be for us, who can be against us? We need to have that faith in God to have valor in evangelism. And the very last thing that I want to talk to you about is this. Sometimes we don't have valor in evangelism. We don't bring the gospel to our friends and our family because we don't want to stand alone. Nobody likes to be alone. Have you ever heard this quote? Doing the right thing when no one is looking is a sign of good character. I believe that's true. If you do the right thing when no one's around, that is good character. But I think doing the right thing when everyone is looking is also the sign of good character, because nobody likes to be singled out, especially if there's controversy involved in it. Is that why sometimes we just don't hold stronger convictions than we do about things? Or maybe why we hold those convictions loosely when we're put under pressure? Maybe it's your friends that weaken your resolve. Have you ever sat at a dinner table wondering, how am I going to handle the fact that all these people around me have ordered alcohol, and now here I am sitting in the middle of them ruining my influence? Even though I'm not drinking, I'm surrounded by it. How do I handle that? Maybe it's your friends at school. Have you ever been the only woman on the PTO that was against maybe them having a dance for the fifth grade or some other crazy thing that some of the schools try to do? That's an uncomfortable feeling, but you've got to stick to your convictions. Maybe it's your family. Are you the only family member that opposes another family member's unscriptural marriage? I am. I've had to face that twice in my family. When are you the only one? You know you're going to be. You're going to be the only one, or you ought to be. I want to tell you just a very quick story about what happened with my son just recently. He works for the local school system, and they were having a party. He's a community educator. He's basically a babysitter. They take care of the after-school kids. They do work really hard, but it's just glorified daycare. But anyway, so he's a community educator, and he's working with these kids, and they're going to have an employee Christmas party. So he signs up to go. He's trying to get along. And then he finds out there's going to be alcohol involved. So he goes to the director and he says, I'm not going to be able to come to the party because there's going to be alcohol. Now he could have said, I'm not coming to the party. I can't. And that would have been true. But he said, I'm not coming to the party because there's going to be alcohol. And the man got mad. And he said, well, I'll think about whether or not I'm going to let you skip the party. And then it got a little heated with Parker saying things like, well, you can't make me. It's optional. And, you know, that's my son. And so then they had a faculty meeting after this little thing that they had. And they have about 150 employees in this organization. And the director got up and said, well, some people are not coming to the Christmas party tonight. Do you have anything to say about that, Parker? And Parker stood up in front of all these college students. Most of them are A&M college students, education majors. And he said, okay, guys, I'm not coming to the party because I don't drink and I don't hang out with people when they're drinking. And I still love you and I still hope that we can have a good working relationship. And if anybody has any questions, just text me or call me and we can study about it. And then he sat back down and they laughed. And he was not happy about it. Even though he had done the right thing, he felt good about that. When he came home, I could tell something's wrong. He was very bothered by it. Well, he went out with us that night, and he kept getting texts and videos from the people. One of them was a girl on her knees, and they were just pouring alcohol. It was disgusting. So we thought that was bad. That was a bad thing, but it was good. Because at about 11:30 that night, he got a call from a girl that had been at the party, and she said, Parker, I went to that party, and it was disgusting, and I want to talk to you more about the Bible and what you believe about alcohol. What does the Bible teach about that? What were you saying that we could study about? And they had this big study about alcohol because he was willing to be the only one. Now, when he first told me about that, I could have gotten arrested. That's how angry I was. I wanted to go up there. Who's the director? Who's running this show? But he's 19, so there's not a whole lot I can do about it. But now, after it played out, I thought, that was a good thing. That was a good thing. That girl was able to learn the truth about that. So to overcome the fear of being the only one standing alone, I want you to look around and realize that you are not the only one. Remember Elijah? Remember how Jezebel was after them and he went into the woods and he was so discouraged he ended up in a cave and the Lord came to him and said, what are you doing? And in 1 Kings 19 and verse 10, he said, I only am left. He felt so sorry for himself. And the Lord had to remind him that there were thousands who had not bowed the knee to Baal. So do you ever feel like you're the only one? Well, thousands have not bowed the knee to Baal. You are not alone. But could it be that we feel alone sometimes? Because this is not something that we talk about with one another. You know, we're supposed to be encouraging and admonishing one another when it comes to evangelism. Hebrews 10:24 says that we are to consider one another, to provoke or stir up into love and good works. Can you think of a better work than evangelizing someone, than teaching someone the gospel? You ought never to feel alone. Like I ought to be asking you, how's that study going with your coworker? Do you know anyone that you can study with? Do you know anyone I can study with? Who's your neighbor? Where do they? We ought to always be talking that up and encouraging one another. My daughter Sophie, she has this question that she started asking lately. It's just apparently weighing very heavily on her. We'll meet someone new and she'll say after we walk away from them, is she lost? Is he lost? And it wasn't that long ago that she was across the street playing with the neighbor and she came running in the house and she said, hurry, Dad, hurry. And her dad said, what's going on? And she said, Justin, across the street, he says the Bible that we believe, it's phony baloney. You've got to hurry, Dad. And Wade said, what do you want me to do about this? And she said, I want you to hurry. I want you to go over there and study with him before Jesus comes back and he is lost. Now, do we have that attitude? Are we trying to hurry and study with people before Jesus comes back and they're lost? Hebrews 3 and verse 13 says, but exhort one another daily while it is called today. Today, think of someone that you can study with. Today, think of someone that you can approach with the gospel. You know, that's how we'll overcome our fear of being singled out, of being alone. Instead of asking, oh, what do they think of me? What does she think of me? Ask yourself, what does God think of them? What position are they in? And if God knows that she's lost, if we know that our friend is lost, then we need to, like Sophie said, hurry, hurry, and teach them. And finally, you just got to be tough. You've got to be tough. It's not always easy. But Hebrews 13:6 says, that so that we may boldly say, that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear what man shall do unto me. And that is something that you had better be teaching your kids, and you better be teaching them well in this area, because it's going to happen. You're going to be the only one, the only parent in the stands at a ball game that will not allow their child to miss services to go to the ball tournament. You're going to be the only one. And if you can't be, how can you turn? Because you know your main purpose in being in those stands is to teach the gospel. That's your main purpose everywhere you go, is to teach the gospel. So if you're not willing to stand up and be the only one there, how can you be the only one that has the truth and share it with other people in the stands? You can't. You can't. If you are not willing and able to be the only one that doesn't drink, then how can you turn to the person next to you at the dinner table and be the only one who has the answer to what must I do to be saved? Are you ashamed of the gospel? Romans 1:16 says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God unto salvation. You have the gospel. You can't be ashamed of it. Those people in the stands, those people at my son's work, they are depending on us to live holy lives and be sacrificial and be the only one, because in a lot of cases, we are the only ones that can bring the gospel to them. What would you do if you are not afraid of anything? Would you parachute out of a plane? Would you bungee jump? Would you swim in the creek at camp? If you were not afraid of anything, what about in evangelism? What if in evangelism you were not afraid of anything? Would you teach a ladies' class? Would you go next door to your neighbor and invite her over for coffee so that you could talk about her soul? Would you ask the cashier to worship with you? What would you do if you were not afraid of anything? Would you mention the church everywhere you went without shame and embarrassment? You've got to do that thing that you think you cannot do. You know, psychologists say that fear starts right here. Fear starts in the brain. And then it triggers this response. Your heart starts to beat. Your breath gets shallow. Your blood pressure rises. And we call that a threat stimulus. And as I close this lesson, I want to talk to you about that threat stimulus. Now, we're out here in the woods, and some of you are afraid of snakes. I know that you are. It's very common to be afraid of snakes. And I'm afraid of snakes. But you know what happened not too long ago? I was at home and I was working. I was very busy and engrossed in my work. And one of the kids came running in and said, Mom, there's a snake in the front yard. Well, Wade was far away. Parker was at work. I guess it was up to me. So I got up, I went to the garage, I got a shovel, I walked out, I found the snake, I chopped the snake's head off, I scooped up the snake, I threw it off over the back fence. I went and I sat back down, and it wasn't until I went back to the computer that I thought, what have I become? What? Is this what happens when you move to Texas? You just get so tough. It really was an empowering moment, I tell you. I am afraid of snakes, but you see, it depended on me. I was the only one that could take care of that. When it depended on me, when I realized I'm bigger than that snake, it can't hurt me. I have a weapon. It's threatening someone I love. Well, I just took care of it. Well, you know, it's no accident that the Bible calls the devil a snake, a serpent. Revelation 12:9 says, that old serpent, the devil, he deceives the whole world. And he's the beginning of our fears. He puts them right up here and tries to paralyze us. But when it depends on you, and it does, when the threat is to someone that you love, when you realize that God is bigger than your fear, and you're armed with a weapon, you know, the sword of the Spirit, you'll kill that snake. You'll kill those fears. You'll defeat that fear, and you'll just say, I can teach the gospel to my friend. I will teach the gospel to my friend, and you'll go next door and you'll talk to your neighbor.